Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm glad to be with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this morning for Kathleen Dunn. And happy Memorial Day to you. Well, it's Monday, and it's time for All Things Political. This past week, headlines continue to be dominated by the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Top Kill, of course, failed, so it's on to the next idea there. And President Obama is on the hot seat for the incident, and the MMS agency is being reconfigured in the wake of the disaster. Also this week, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is pressing China for a level playing field for American businesses, among other things. And this morning, we're hearing reports of the Israeli Navy raiding a flotilla of pro-Palestinian activists and killing at least 10. So we're following that story as well. Well, it's all on the table this morning as we're joined by Paul Singer, the associate editor at Roll Call, the newspaper of Capitol Hill. And we're happy to take your phone calls this morning. Who's to blame for the BP oil spill? Is this disaster finally landing on President Obama's doorstep? And what about Hillary Clinton's trip to China? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Paul Singer, so glad you could join us this Memorial Day.
Good morning, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. So looking at BP again, the top story, continuing to be the top story, we had a promising remedy there for a while, Top Kill. It certainly sounded like it was going to be science fiction-y and like it was really going to take care of business, but it didn't. Yeah. Is anyone surprised by this?
I don't know about surprise. I mean, I think everybody sort of acknowledged and has acknowledged throughout that, you know, they don't really know exactly what they're doing down there. And I don't mean that as a criticism in the sense that they're, you know, incompetent. I mean, there's real questions about how much technological expertise we have in these deep water wells. I mean, this is a new environment for most oil drilling. It is an incredibly difficult environment to operate in, and I think there has been some warning throughout that we don't know that any of this is going to work. And yesterday, Carol Browner, who is sort of the energy guru in the White House, said as much. She said, you know, they're going to attempt this new technique starting the next couple of days to cut off the riser and basically try to drop a cone over the top of it. But even at that rate, she said, it's likely there's going to be some sort of, even if this is successful, it's likely there'll be some sort of seepage or leakage continuing through until August.
And in the meantime, we could see increased flow of oil for about a week or so, right?
Yep. And keep in mind, now we have hurricane season approaching. We have even your top-of-the-hour weather report. There's a wind picking up in the Gulf. It's going to start pushing this stuff further and further inland, which is, or, you know, towards land, which is not good.
Well, obviously, this has exposed a lot of gaps in the technology and lack of foresight on the part of the oil companies and probably lack of imagination on the part of the U.S. government. What do you see is happening at this juncture in time in terms of regulation?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The thing that this whole event really brings home to me is the notion that the worst thing for the President of the United States at any time is to appear powerless. That's not what the job is supposed to be. It's supposed to be the most powerful man in the world, or woman someday. And at the moment, you know, Obama appears powerless. There's just not much he can do to stop the leak. Now, there's a bunch of stuff he can do and to some degree has been doing to try and improve either the emergency response right now that the government is applying or sort of the infrastructure that allowed this to happen. I mean, there have been reforms going on at a not particularly aggressive level in the Minerals Management Service at the Department of Interior before this happened. Needless to say, after this happened, the pace of change picked up somewhat. Mm-hmm. But it's really, you know, and there's also a whole series of regulations now coming out. I mean, 2 or 3 months ago, we were talking about opening a whole new round of underwater drilling, offshore oil drilling. Now, not surprisingly, we are not talking about that. We're talking about a moratorium. I mean, but there's really little he can do in the instant emergency. That's the thing that I think is so frustrating. frustrating for this White House is that the president, like the rest of us, can simply stand on shore and look out at this increasing oil slick and go, wow, I wish we could stop that. Please make it stop.
So what about James Carville's criticism then that he needs to be in BP's face saying you got to take care of this and now? I mean, is that just pretty sounding rhetoric?
Yeah, well, what can you exactly tell BP? You know, go, hurry, get. You know, I mean, there's not, keep in mind, BP has the greatest incentive of anybody to stop the flow of oil because they're paying by the gallon, right? They will be fined by the gallon, by the barrel for any leak, any damage that is caused. They're also, this is their product. This is what they sell, right? So they're losing product every day, too. I don't accuse them of dallying in this matter. They may be underestimating the leak flow. They may be doing a whole bunch of nefarious things. But my suspicion is, and I think just for basic economic reasons, and not to mention political reasons, BP would love to stop this flow, too. And there's not a whole lot the president can do except yell at them to go do it more. And again, you know, the government does not maintain most of the hardware that you would need to stop the flow. Now, there's a whole separate series of discussions about whether the government has been doing enough on shore to prevent the seepage of oil onto shore. And that's a more complicated discussion because the Coast Guard does have boats, the Coast Guard does have boom, the Coast Guard does have access to some of these cleaning supplies, so it is possible. And again, I have to admit here, I'm not an expert in oil spill cleanup. I'm not an expert in this particular response. I don't know whether the government has done absolutely everything possible to the greatest degree possible to protect the shoreline. I just don't know. And there, I suspect, will be a whole host of after-action reports saying, you know, we could have done this better, we could have done that better. That's the thing that Obama does control. But again, all he can do is say, get as much as we got, get it all down there, and do something with it.
Well, to take a step back from what Obama can and cannot do about the oil spill, one thing which is happening regardless is his presidency is taking a hit. I think that given the aftermath of healthcare reform, which did pass, but it came at a cost, he was limping along a bit, and now this comes, and he's taking another hit, and the sharks are in the water.
Well, again, that's sort of what I mean about the powerlessness of the presidency. I mean, the political danger to the president at any given moment is to not have a good solution to things at hand. Right. And you know, in the past, it has not been a good week for the president in that regard. I mean, first of all, we've got oil that he can't stop. We've got some wackiness going on in North Korea that is not entirely clear what our response is, like what our available responses are. We have this whole dust up about did he try to offer a job to Joe Sestak to get him to not run for Senate in Pennsylvania, which, again, you know, maybe a minor blip on the controversy radar, but it sort of once again points out that whatever the Obama administration tried to do in that regard didn't succeed and ended up making them look silly. All these things, I mean, the whole idea, the political idea for the president, any president, is to maintain this posture of competence. I can help you solve your problem, and I can help the nation address its problems. Well, this week has not been a good problem-solving week for the Obama administration.
I want to take a phone call since we're on the topic of BP. We've got Ivy calling from Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. I just wanted to add some insight to this, I think. I worked for the Forest Service for a while in the 80s, working in wildlife and fire and timber sale stuff. Mm-hmm. And when the spotted owl controversy came up, it caused a lot of problems within the agency. And I think what it is that the Forest Service became an agency that was codependent on the industry, and that the people that worked for the Forest Service, they were good people but in timber, but they felt like the people they served was the timber industry. To the effect where, like, when they'd advertise there was a sale in a in the forest I worked on, they advertised it locally, as if it didn't matter to anyone else, as if the land belonged to the timber company that worked it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what happens with the minerals. The people who, and mining and all that sort of thing, is they feel like, we need to get this resource out. And they don't say, okay, our job is to make sure that it's there's not going to be any problems, that this won't affect other people, that this extraction of minerals doesn't pollute the water. They don't look at it as stewards of it anymore. They look at it like they need to get the cut out. And in fact, all the rangers that you would see around were rewarded for getting the volume out, to the effect where they were logging high country areas where the soil was so thin it couldn't really sustain that kind of logging. But they were rewarded because they got the volume out. This is what they felt they should do, to the point where wildlife and any recreation and all other multiple uses that the Forest Service was supposed to provide were like kind of like on the edge frill, and their budgets were really low because they didn't bring in the bucks and all that sort of thing. So, and that's what happens when you put somebody who's training horses in charge of, like, with Katrina and all that. I mean, what's a person like that doing running, our emergency?
Thank you, Ivy. Let's see what Paul Singer has to say.
And you know, you touch on something, Ivy, that has been a real problem for years for the Mineral Management Service at the Department of Interior, which is there has been this real coziness between the agency and the regulated community. And, in fact, it's kind of interesting. The Department of Interior Inspector General put out a new report a week ago, end of May, May 24th, I think it was, that it was sort of a hurry-up report. They had been working on a report for a while about improprieties in the Mineral Management Service office in the Gulf of Mexico. And they essentially put it out a little bit ahead of time because in the wake of this Deepwater Horizon disaster, they wanted to sort of raise some attention to the problem. But essentially what they found out was that in 2006-07, I think it goes back 2005-06-07, I think, actually, a bunch of the employees were taking gifts from a bunch of the corporations they were regulating. They were all going on fishing trips together. They were all going on hunting trips together. One inspector was going out to inspect oil wells at the same time he was negotiating for a job with the company he was inspecting. And what was most interesting to me is the cover letter that went with this report. Because the cover letter said, look, there's stuff in this report that we didn't really get to, or that there's stuff out there that really didn't show up in the report. And what we're really concerned about is a lot of these guys who work for the government as the regulatory agency have been long-time childhood friends with a lot of the oil industry guys down there, too. Everybody knows each other. They all work together. They sort of rotate in and out. Maybe you're in government at one point, you're in industry at another point, you all go to the same school, you all go to the same church, whatever else. And it's hard to sort of get any true independent regulatory authority because they're all just cozy. They're pals. It's a really interesting report because it just sort of speaks to how do you in a community like this, it's a relatively small community, it's a lot of folks in the community are involved in the oil industry, how do you establish where the lines of conflict of interest start and stop? Now, of course, and as a result of all this stuff, the administration has proposed splitting MMS into three different divisions, so there'll be sort of separate agencies doing the permitting and doing the royalty collection and doing the oversight. There'll be some division between them, hopefully therefore eliminating some of the conflict. But you're exactly right. I mean, these are agencies, and keep in mind, this is also an agency that's funded by the royalties it collects from the industry. So it's not even one of these things that the federal government every year has to appropriate money for and therefore sort of do a little oversight. It just sort of operates in its own budget world. So there are a lot of real concerns about how do you get a truly independent overseer onto these projects.
And there are skeptics already that splitting the agency is not, in fact, going to take care of the problem, and it's probably coming too late to help President Obama in terms of his public appearance on the disaster.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, again, The only thing that's going to matter from public appearance standpoint is Dirty Pelicans. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, there's nothing he can do bureaucratically, and I don't mean, again, that's not a criticism. I mean, literally, there's nothing he can do using the levers of government that will in any way compete with the picture on the NBC News of a dirty pelican. And we're going to start getting a lot of them, and we're going to see all these wetlands soiled with oil, and it is exact. I mean, I will say this about the parallel to Katrina, aside from the fact they're both in Louisiana, is that a picture is worth a thousand words, and the pictures of Katrina were horrible, and the pictures of dirty pelicans are going to get horrible, and there's just nothing you can do to combat that from a political standpoint.
Well, we need to take our first break right now, and then we'll come back and we'll continue talking about the headlines of the recent week with Paul Singer, the associate editor at Roll Call, the newspaper of Capitol Hill. And we'd be happy to take your phone call this morning. What do you think about the BP oil spill, and what do you see coming down the pike in terms of President Obama and coming regulation? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Memorial Day. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this morning with Paul Singer, the associate editor of Roll Call, the newspaper of Capitol Hill. So far, we've touched on the BP oil spill and mentioned a few other headlines, but we'll see what you want to talk about, too. We've got Jim right now on the line calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. The headlines for today, of course, is Memorial Day, and yesterday I heard part of Ray Charles' soulful rendition of America the Beautiful, and it struck me that perhaps we're not so beautiful in some ways, and maybe we should take a look at that and humble ourselves a bit. In the Texas textbooks, of course, we're trying to revise American history, but you know what has been our history? We've had a history of saying that the only good Indian was a dead Indian. We've talked about, we've been provoked by pigs who wanted us to hate jigs, to bop wops, set goals to abuse Poles or to put the screws to Jews. People who encouraged Hicks to scorn Micks and Spicks. And
right, there's a lot of ugly stuff out there.
Yes, and so, and beyond that, of course, we've had situations of abusing people in the third world for reasons of money and power to exploit the cheap labor and resources. And Reverend Wright, of course, came into great controversy for talking about God's damnation to America. Maybe what he should have said is to ask us for God to inform America and to forgive America and perhaps also to save America from our prejudice towards other people who are different from us.
Jim, did you have a question? That one of the things that I find, I'm a reporter, this is what I do for a living, and I traffic in information. And one of the things I find really extraordinary is that the internet and access to information it's an amazing innovation. It's an amazing empowerment tool that has been created, and again, largely out of our country, which is kind of a neat thing. You know, we've helped develop this extraordinary new tool for how people can learn about the world, how people can share information, how people can get to know each other. And yet, one of the great results of that is that people can get on blog sites with anonymous names and spew venom in ways they never could before. You know, it's just every advance has its pros and its cons. And in some ways, America is an exceptional nation of great, enormous power and enormous wealth, enormous natural resources and bounty. It's a spectacular country. And on the other hand, sometimes America has very rough edges, very sharp elbows, and is a little stubborn, you know, and doesn't play nicely with neighbors. I can never condemn this country for its failings without also recognizing its successes, and kind of vice versa.
All right, well, thank you for the call, Jim. And a call now from Douglas in Madison. Hi, Douglas.
Hi. I'm calling to raise awareness and talk a little bit about the Israeli attacks on the Gaza aid fleet that happened last night. Al Jazeera is now reporting that at least 19 people were killed, and this is after a long string of attacks on Gaza aid ships trying to break the internationally recognized illegal sequestering of the Gaza Strip, which is really an open-air prison. And I'm really wanting to know when the speaker thinks, or when our reporter thinks that enough is enough in terms of U.S. unconditional support of the Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. The current budget has $3 billion for military aid to Israel, and this U.S. aid is being used to kill civilians, and I'm wondering what your comments would be about what the U.S. response to this should be.
I have no opinions. In fact, as a professional reporter, I have no opinions about almost anything. What I can tell you is what I know, which is not a whole lot about this attack. My understanding is that there was a flotilla of aid going to Gaza. My understanding, it was intended in part as a protest to challenge the validity of that blockade. My understanding is that the Israelis have intercepted and diverted numerous aid shipments to the region, and that there was anticipated that this would sort of go the same way, which is the boats would arrive, the Israelis would sort of herd them up and capture the ships, move them to a port where they could be inspected and offloaded, and then at least theoretically, according to the Israelis, delivered the supplies to the region, to Gaza. That's not what happened here, and I don't know why. I don't know. Obviously, there's a who shot first question going on here. The White House response has been very measured at this point. They said we're very concerned about it. We'd like to see more. I just don't think we have a whole lot of information about it. What I can tell you politically is American support for Israel is not going anywhere. It is an extraordinarily popular position in the Republican Party that Israel is a partner to be supported, sometimes at all costs. In the Democratic Party, I think, as well, it is a very closely held alliance. There is a special relationship there, I think, is undoubtable. It is interesting that there has been some real frostiness in that relationship in the past 6 months or so. I don't know what to make of that frostiness. I don't know whether it is simply Netanyahu and Obama not necessarily seeing eye to eye on some issues. In some cases, you know, the Israelis were fairly impolite to Vice President Biden when he was there. This is a relationship that is going to continue, and it is going to continue. Your tax dollars are going to continue supporting Israel at a high level, and that's simply a political reality. I don't say whether it's good or bad because I don't have an opinion about it, but it is a political reality.
What about public opinion taking a toll on something like this if the U.S. doesn't send some sort of censure?
Yeah, well, this is always a sort of delicate dance, right? I mean, there will be, I suspect, some sort of response from the United States if they can conclude that the Israelis overreacted. The Israelis, I suspect, will, and again, this is suspicion. It's early in this incident. We don't know a whole lot about it yet. I have seen some news reports that the Israelis say that they were attempting to board the ships peacefully and they were attacked. I have no independent verification of that. I was not there. I suspect the United States will take a very serious and hard look at this, but I am not particularly expecting, you know, a strong and vociferous condemnation at this point.
What is President Obama doing for Memorial Day, do you know?
He was in Chicago. He's been in Chicago for the past couple of days. It was actually very low-key. He was just with some family and friends. I believe he's having an event Yeah, I have to apologize. I know he's not at Arlington Cemetery.
Right. There was some criticism about that, right?
Yeah, there was some criticism about that, about not his not being at Arlington Cemetery.
He sent Biden, I think.
That's right. But I believe he's doing a veterans event, and I think it's in Chicago, but I apologize. I just don't remember where he was this morning. I haven't checked my White House schedule yet this morning. But, yeah, he got some criticism for not doing the sort of traditional Veterans Day event at Arlington Cemetery. Although, if I can put in a plug for a friend of mine, a guy named Mark Benjamin at Salon.com has done some spectacular reporting on the troubles at Arlington Cemetery. And on this Memorial Day, it would be worth some of your listeners taking a look at some of that stuff. There's been some real problems at Arlington Cemetery. They have misplaced the remains of soldiers, which is just criminal. And Mark has done just spectacular work reporting that story.
That sounds interesting. Of course, that wouldn't be tied in with Obama's absence there,
nope.
But it sounds as though that's a timely topic to take a look at, too. And I wonder, his weekend in Chicago over the Memorial Day weekend, is there any sense that he's, you know, the old Nero fiddling while Rome burns sense with the oil spill? I mean, I guess you can't really expect him to be camped out on the shore of Louisiana looking harried, but is he doing the appropriate thing right now?
You know, it's funny. During the press conference last week, he said something about how, you know, this oil spill is what I think about every morning and every day and every night, and then my daughter comes in every morning and says, "Did you stop the leak yet, Daddy?" You know?
Mm.
But even during that day, even before the press conference, he was meeting with the championship basketball team, and he was meeting with the U.S. soccer team, I think. You know, the President of the United States can never focus on one thing. And then, lo and behold, you know, again, something's going to stir up in Israel. There's going to be an attack on a boat in Gaza. Well, needless to say, we're not talking about oil at that point. And the president can't be down there standing on the shore staring at the oil slick when he has to be figuring out what to do about, you know, an Israeli attack on a boat in Gaza. So,
right, but instead there are pictures of him walking his dog.
Yeah, that's true. And keep in mind, by the way, he did not go out and party while he was in Chicago. It was a very low-key event. He did not have a lot of public. He didn't go out to a nice dinner with his wife. They mostly stayed in. So I think they're aware of that. This is a challenge for every president. How do you appear engaged at the critical moment at every time, all the time, and yet at the same time have what I think is pretty widely agreed the right to have a vacation, to take a weekend off. You know what I mean? It's tough, and I think the way they're managing it now is send him to Chicago for a couple of days. And don't do anything big and splashy in public.
Well, I was just thinking of the comparison between Bush during Katrina, and that didn't work out so well for him.
It didn't work.
Staying
out
behind.
It did not. And you know, there have been, it's for years, these have been, well, you know, the president's going away in August and they're going on vacation to wherever they went. And invariably something happens somewhere. Again, the powerlessness of the presidency, you can't put it on hold.
Let's go back to the phones right now. We have got Steve on the line from La Crosse. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I've just got a couple kind of questions and comments, and one is on my internet provider news service. AP reported last week, that BP was actually in charge of the Exxon Valdez cleanup, and it took more than 12 hours to get there, and then they kind of hemmed and hawed and kind of screwed that up, too, by taking too long to start the cleanup. And also, BP had a huge Arctic pipeline leak a couple of years ago, and they kind of hemmed and hawed against that and said, "Yeah, we kind of screwed this up." And I've never heard any NPR or any other news people make commentary on their sloppy way to clean up these spills. And also, the other thing that I'm kind of wondering about is with the you brought up earlier about how the regulatory system and the oil people seem to be in bed with each other. And that is, what about Cheney's secret meeting on energy policy where he brought all these oil companies and they went behind closed doors, nobody said anything? Why isn't anybody addressing that and seeing if maybe that's when they got over cozy? And the other comment I wanted to make is on the Israeli attack, and that is, once again, the Israeli, I believe, did their thing again. It's like a couple of years ago, we had the American college student there that was trying to block the bulldozer. They just ran over and killed her. And again, no one seems to be addressing that. And I'll take my questions off, or take your responses off the air.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Paul Singer?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there was, actually, I saw a statistic go by yesterday that, you know, BP had a significant number of safety violations in the past. I will tell you that I've actually been to the BP facilities in Alaska. Here's my conflict of interest admission that my brother actually works for BP, but in a faraway land, not here. So I've actually been to the BP facilities in Alaska, and it's kind of a fascinating, if you've never seen, you know, these oil operations up close, they're giant, unspeakably giant industrial operations. I mean, it's incredible, and particularly in Alaska, that's an operation that goes on for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. You fly north in Alaska over nothing for hundreds of miles, and you get literally to the edge of God's green earth, which is right at the rim of the Arctic Ocean. And there is this industrial facility 30 miles long of pipeline and drilling platforms and airstrips and all this stuff. And it's kind of mind-blowing. There have been, you know, this is not the cleanest industry in the world. It is not a flawless operation. There have been a lot of leaks, and there, I suspect, will continue to be a lot of leaks. I think that's one of the reasons we take response seriously and why you have to prepare for emergencies, because there's going to be emergencies. I think one of the things that makes this particular one so much more problematic is that it's in a place where we can't get to it.
Which they should have anticipated.
That's right.
I mean, that's just it, though. I mean, we've had how many years since the Exxon Valdez? And you sort of think, instead of looking at that as a freakish blip that will never happen again, you know, Talk of the Nation just did a show last Friday about where's the planning been all this year? Where's the technology in case of another disaster?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's right. And when you start down this road of new deep water welling, I mean, these wells are in the Gulf, these deep water wells are sort of a new horizon in this technology. When you start down the road of planning for these things, is the emergency response built into the planning before you start to drill? You know what I mean? I mean, have you considered what are we going to do in a worst-case scenario? Do we have a robot that will get down there? And it looks like the answer is no. They didn't really think that far ahead. Now, again, it also looks like when they built this well, they built it wrong. I mean, it was just a flawed well. Which is what we think is the cause of explosion. But, you know, all of that yet to be determined.
Well, thank you for your call, Steve. And how about a call from Judy calling from Milwaukee? Hi, Judy.
Yes, I'm surprised at myself because I feel no passion about this. I feel as if you play with fire and you get burned. People have made a commitment to oil at all costs and are willing to do anything to get oil at all costs. And what did you expect? What were they thinking?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is no doubt that one of the morals of the story of the deepwater oil spill will be that oil has consequences. And the more oil we want, the more we are tied to those consequences, and the harder it will be to avoid them. And those consequences range from, you know, an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico to an oil spill in Alaska to a tanker breaking up in the ocean to a war breaking out someplace over oil. I mean, that is part of this deal we have made. And I think you're right that if nothing else, this drives home the point that thirst for oil is not without consequences, whether or not that empowers change. I mean, you know, one of the things that we've heard here in Washington is that this spill might actually drive a new piece of legislation to, you know, speed up investments in new technologies that are not oil. Maybe that will be the result. I do not know. I've heard that every year for the 27 years I've been down here reporting. So, you know, who knows?
Well, and President Obama has suspended plans for further offshore drilling, but you don't see, say, Republicans backpedaling from drilling plans either. So is this just going to come down upon partisan lines?
Oh, no. My impression is that Republicans, at least in Washington, have been pretty measured in their response to this one and have said, you know, have taken the position at the moment, at least, that, yeah, the idea of stopping and seeing what went wrong makes sense. I don't think nobody has said drill, baby, drill since, whatever it was, April 20th.
But I have read about opposition to the moratorium on drilling.
Yes. Yeah, because, again, you're going to get back to this issue of, well, this is a really rare accident. These other places are not the same environment. We know a lot more about them. It's actually, you know, been a relatively... I mean, in fact, even, you know, keep in mind, when Obama a couple of months ago was lifting the moratorium and allowing more drilling, he said, look, it's been a really safe industry. We haven't had major leaks. We know how to do this pretty well. Suddenly one leak changes your dynamic a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and of course, there will be plenty of political hay to be made about this thing. I agree with the caller that thirst for oil has these consequences. The problem is there's no short-term solution to that problem except get more oil.
Well, let's pause a moment, and we can take our second break right now. We're doing all things political this morning with our guest, Paul Singer. He's associate editor at Roll Call, the newspaper of Capitol Hill. And we're taking your phone calls this morning as well, whether about the BP oil spill. Maybe you'd like to talk further about the Israeli raid on the flotilla to the Gaza Strip. Maybe something else on your mind this Memorial Day weekend. Just give us a call, and we'll be happy to talk to you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, and our email remains talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Memorial Day. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, as we talk with Paul Singer, the associate editor of Roll Call, the newspaper of Capitol Hill. And we'll take our next phone call right now. We have Sarah with us from Zion, Illinois. Hey, Sarah.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm wondering if you happen to know if there's ever been a bigger oil spill in the world. And then my other question is, well, my comment is that it just seems to me that people are talking about the spill as if it's like something that's contained and done and we're going to clean it up, and then there's going to be political fallout and we have to decide what our policy is going to be in the future. But it seems to me the bigger issue is that this spill is just, I mean, it's going to go on and on and on, and it's going to be millions and millions and millions of gallons and barrels. And I want to think about what the effects of the spill are going to be on the ocean and on international relations, and where's that oil going to go, and what's going to happen to it? That's what I want to hear about.
Carol Browner yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, said that this is the worst. This will probably end up being the worst spill in history. You know, one of the things that I'm interested in, and this is just because I had spent a lot of time in Louisiana after Katrina, and there is a portion of the population in Louisiana that is not New Orleans. It's a little bit west of New Orleans in the bayous, and sort of the old Cajun culture down there. A lot of those people are fishermen who work the bayous and the coastline, and they were really concerned. This goes back now 5 years ago. They were really concerned about the impact on their culture, not so much of Katrina, but of Rita, which came afterwards, because both of the hurricanes destroyed these wetlands and devastated some. They were doing a whole lot of wetlands reconstruction down there, and it was all basically washed away by Katrina and Rita. And the concern was, well, this Cajun culture and these fishermen are all going to go away because they're going to lose their livelihoods and their houses have been knocked down and the bayous are unfishable. Well, this is just going to repeat and probably worsen that problem, because now you're going to have a lot of soiled fishing areas for quite a while. And I'm really interested in getting down there. I probably won't get down there, tell you the truth, but I'm really interested in seeing some reporters go down there and sort of follow what happens to Cajun culture in the wake of this. I mean, can these people still stay there and have a livelihood? And but the caller is right. I mean, the question is, even when you get a cork in the spill, then what? You know, now you've got hundreds of thousands of gallons, barrels of oil floating around the Gulf of Mexico. Where does it ultimately go? They do have boats floating around down there trying to suck a lot of it up. They're burning some of it off. They're putting chemical dispersants on it, trying to get rid of it. It's a really good question where it goes. And the minute a glob of oil touches land anywhere, it becomes, that is anywhere that's not U.S., it becomes an international issue that the U.S. will have to deal with.
Well, and there's been a handful of scientists at various universities who have reported a several miles wide plume of oil deep under the ocean. BP is denying that. They've kind of shrugged it off at the moment. I don't know if that's PR or if they've just got other things in their minds, but we do know that there are reports of that going on as well.
Yeah, and I cover politics, not science, so I don't really know. I mean, I'm just not smart enough to know whether that's true or not. But again, I suspect there's going to be a lot of questions over time. How fast will this oil degrade? How fast will it disappear? How, you know, can they pick it all up? Will it separate? Are the dispersants going to be an environmental problem of their own? I suspect you'll be seeing a year from now a whole series of articles about what the real impacts are.
Well, thank you for the call, Sarah. We appreciate that. And a call here from Sally with us from Spring Green. Hi, Sally.
I want people to know, and I'd like to
I'm sorry, Sally. Can you start over once more? I've got your mic up now.
Okay, I'd like to hear from others. My heart is completely broken. I worked for 10 years on wetlands, living in New Orleans and in the heart of the wetlands, down there for whole days at a time, trying to save the pelican. All those pelicans will die on that Chandler Island. They are all going to die. And they had just been taken off the endangered list. Everything about that place is one of the best wetlands ever in the world, where there's the largest diversity of species, birds, insects, reptiles, ants, animals, extraordinarily beautiful plants, colors, the feeling of the whole place. The Cajun culture will disappear completely, all of the lifestyles of all of those people. You cannot clean up any of that. There aren't shores. It's all marsh. The oxygen is lost. The dispersants are extremely toxic.
Okay, well, thank you for that call, Sally. I think a lot of people feel brokenhearted about it, and you're speaking a little there to our previous caller. That's what she wanted to hear about, you know, as well. Paul Singer, did you want to comment?
Well, only I think that gets to the earlier point that you know, the government can do an awful lot to respond and can, you know, make every effort that, you know, I'm getting a daily email from the White House about what we did to respond today. You know, how we were, you know, continuing efforts in the cleanup of this bill. But, one dirty pelican, you know, the photograph is heartbreaking, and there's just no two ways about it, and there's going to be a lot of it. And it really, it's not a problem that is easily solvable, and it's going to continue to pay these really painful dividends.
Well, thank you for the call, Sally. And another call here, this one from Maury in Two Rivers. Hey, Maury.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I know Russia had a couple of these leaks underground, and they couldn't stop them either with the same stuff we're trying.
Hmm.
And they put a small nuclear device down there and blew them out.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And I don't even hear this debate about doing that here. I mean, it's oil going all over, and everybody's all upset about it. And I know we'd have some nuclear stuff down there, but it's got to at least be debated. We've touched off nuclear devices and New Mexico and Pacific Ocean, and we got to have a lot of data on what would happen. But the politicians or whoever, they're not even talking about it.
They're actually,
I don't get it.
There actually has been some conversation about that. Not a lot, and not a lot in public. But yes, you're right. This is a solution that apparently has been tested and apparently had some success in Russia. And all I have seen is one or two statements about that, yeah, we've heard of that, and we're not going to try it. The risks are too great. I'm not a scientist. I don't really know what the risks are. I assume setting off a nuclear weapon around a whole bunch of potentially flammable oil may not be the best idea. I just don't know. But for whatever reason, it has been discussed a little bit. But apparently it was taken off the table pretty early.
Hmm. Hadn't heard about that. So who was discussing it then?
Oh, well, I assume it was one of the things that came up in the
BP?
Yeah, with BP, and keep in mind the government is very involved in all this stuff. I mean, all the solutions that are being trotted out there have to be run by government regulators, the Department of Energy, and presumably Department of Interior to say, can we do this? And needless to say, of course, BP does not actually have any nukes. So at least not that we know of. If it was going to be a nuclear weapon, that would be a government operation all the way. So presumably that's something the government sort of, chewed over and dismissed. Can I just mention, by the way, since this was a lot of this telephone call, we discussed the Israeli attack. I just got a news alert from Reuters that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has canceled plans to meet Obama at the White House tomorrow. So we're already seeing how this may increase the tensions between the U.S. and Israel.
That seems like a big deal.
It does seem like a big deal.
Is that more than you expected?
I don't really know how to answer that question. I hadn't thought of it. I hadn't really thought of it that way. It doesn't surprise me, I suppose, now in hindsight, that given what little we know, given that I don't think either one of them wants to have a photo op with the other one at the moment,
right?
I guess it doesn't surprise me all that much. But, I think this does speak to the fact that there really are tensions between our government and theirs.
Well, thanks for the updates. We'll have to check on that later as well. Mm-hmm. And Carl with us from Madison. Hi, Carl.
Howdy, Veronica and Mr. Singer. I don't know who Rand Paul's Democratic opponent is going to be in the November election, the Democrat. But I'm rather interested in the brouhaha that occurred last week and obviously about the 1964 the Voting Rights and Act. Do you have any comments about both nationally and especially locally about what aspects of this brouhaha might have legs?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to... let me put it this way. The question that has been surrounding Rand Paul and all the Tea Party candidates, frankly, is how well will they play on a broader stage? They clearly have a lot of enthusiastic supporters who will turn out for a Republican primary. And they clearly have a lot of energy at the moment in the public eye. I mean, this whole notion of the Tea Party protests of reduced taxes, reduced government spending, and sort of a limited role of government is a very popular idea. But a lot of these people are neophytes to political campaigns, which, by the way, that's part of their charm, is that they're outsiders, they're not professional politicians. Well, the downside of that is that sometimes, because you're not a professional politician, you don't have people writing your talking points for you. You say something that gets you in hot water. So I don't really know on the ground of Kentucky how those comments about the Civil Rights Act are going to resonate. I will tell you that all the political analysis that we have done and that others have done have shifted that race. So that race was considered leaning Republican. That was, the anticipation was that Republicans would win that Senate seat. It is now being rated closer to a toss-up. It has moved some, and it looks like it's going to be a tougher slog for the Republicans in that race than we anticipated. So I don't know which specific part of this controversy will last. I don't know that it will last. But, again, the joys for reporters of having inexperienced candidates running for high-profile offices is that they frequently stick their foot in their mouths, and we like that part because it makes it entertaining. So I would not be surprised, I guess what I'm saying, to see another dust-up like this on some other topic where Rand Paul, who is not a professional politician, says something that is a little impolitic.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Carl. We appreciate that. And we're getting close to the end of the hour. We've got about less than a minute to go. And I just wanted to touch on Palin because she's been staying visible during this oil disaster. And, of course, she was a part of the Tea Party as well. And can you tell us a little bit about how you see Palin playing out in the next election?
I don't know.
In about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, Sarah Palin energized a base of the party. Keep in mind, I covered the Reform Party in 2000, right? I've previously been a reporter at the time of the Ross Perot movement. You know, there are a lot of energizing figures who are managed to really capture the public imagination. What we don't know is whether they're actually able to deliver significant ballot box success. The Reform Party didn't really manage to elect a lot of people. Ralph Nader and the Green Party didn't really manage to elect a lot of people. I don't know whether the Tea Party movement, and even with Sarah Palin sort of urging on this kind of populist movement, I just don't know how much impact that has.
We can leave it there, but thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great Memorial Day.
Have a great Memorial Day. Thank you so much. Paul Singer, Associate Editor of Roll Call. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.